You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Maggie Hinders. She's in New York City. Maggie, thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks, Brainerd.
So, Maggie, I know you're both senior designer at Random House and also a painter, and I want to begin by just talking about your work and ask you what are you working on now in terms of painting in your studio?
Right now I'm working on a series of paintings that are based on the faces of, and they're large, they're based on the faces of puppies and kittens, but the focus of them really is the gaze of the animal, and the animal is looking from the out at the viewer from the canvas. Now these are sort of graphic, sort of abstract, but there is a recognizable face, and it's recognizably an animal, so I don't know how clear that is, but that's what I'm working on right now.
Well, that's interesting. I mean, I think, you know, that is understandable, but you're talking about, like, the gaze of the animal? I mean, there is this kind of art historical thing, right, about the gaze, the male gaze or the female gaze.
Mm-hmm.
Am I reaching too far to say this is about kind of the animal gaze, or is it something else?
No, that's exactly what it is. The animal is looking back, and at least the way I feel it, you know, there really is a connection. When your eyes connect with the eyes that are in the canvas, even though it's not, there's no animal really there and there's nothing living, you have a response to it just because there's something about something looking at you that just creates a reaction.
Well, that's interesting. Is it, are they taken from life? Are you using like existing imagery? How do you get that kind of gaze to work with?
Well, I've been experimenting with sort of different sources. Some of the images, at least especially in the beginning, were taken from photographs and then extrapolated, and you know, backgrounds and foregrounds put in and all that stuff, so that the abstraction and process sort of took place. As I continued, they became more and more just unrelated to source material and just sort of a quick cartoon or something like that as the fundamental drawing. And then the things that happened all over the canvas were more just more the point of the whole thing. So there really is a piece of artwork there that's almost independent of the face that's in the canvas. This is really hard to describe in words, but that's the best I can do at the moment.
Well, that's okay. There'll be some images with the interview, but I think that's clear that the content you're saying of the gaze or the animal is also independent from all the forms and color and light that's within it as well, which
right.
is, you know, what separates it from perhaps a traditional photograph, or I suppose even photographs could have that in it, but that there's many other elements happening in there.
Yeah.
To talk a little bit about, again, the kind of relationship to the animal, because that does seem like about a relationship, right? When we have viewers or figures gazing at us from the canvas and looking directly out, it kind of almost implicates the audience in some way, or asks a question in some way. And animals are, and pets and cats and, you know, dogs are so different. And we kind of, I suppose, you know, kind of anthropomorphize them, right? We think that they are thinking certain things or being certain ways. When you do it, is that part of the content? Is it also about, what I'm asking is, I guess I think about your relationship to animals. Is that part of what you're communicating here? Because animals, of course, could also be simply cute and adorable. Is it about their beauty, or is it also about a relationship, or how they're thinking or feeling or whatever's happening within the animals' minds?
I think it is more about the relationship. You know, a lot of this is just unconscious, the way these choices get made, but I think the things that appeal to me are the relationships involved as opposed to just, I don't know, anyway, it's just the back and forth between, like, say, for example, the animal and me, or whatever the relationship is more important to me than just simply looking at something, or just the thing being independent and like kind of running along parallel lines. That's not making sense, but
no, that is making sense. That is making sense because I know it's sort of a hard question, but it is kind of. You know, there's two things happening at once. There is, you know, because they're portraits, really, right? We're talking kind of about portraits and whether the portraits are reading the subject at all or telling us something about the subject.
Yeah, I think that's the part of it. I think that's one reason that it's being an animal is a little bit more interactive in a way, because I think that people tend to project more onto an animal than they would onto another person. Probably because the animal can't speak back, but for whatever reason, I feel that way.
I think that's
true. So these things sort of, I don't know, I experience when I'm working on them and when I'm looking at them, I kind of experience a sort of circular thing, a back and forth between myself and the picture.
In the sense of the pictures talking to you? I mean, artists often talk about that, right? Whether it's abstract painting or figurative, the image can kind of talk to you. There's a dialogue with it. Is that what you mean?
Kind of, yeah. Yeah, I think that's... This actually is more to do with when I'm looking at it. When I'm actually working on it, there are times when, you know, because they're large, I'm working on a detail and I might be thinking about the overall thing, but what I'm actually engaged with is something really much smaller and more abstract. It's just a, you know, making an edge line up, a yellow against the black or whatever colors.
Hmm. And
that's sort of the back and forth.
Yeah, so that's part of the back and forth. You mean the kind of the formal issues of the painting talk to you in terms of light and color and form?
Yeah, and it might be saying, I need this, I need that, or something like that. But you know, especially when you're working large, but you're actually paying close attention to certain details, you do have to just, I guess, go back and forth between, and physically go back and forth even, like you're right, 2 inches from the canvas, and then you have to go back 10 feet so that you can see what you've done and how it works with everything else.
Sure, that makes sense. And in the history of your work, of your painting, has it always been in this kind of mode? Have you been working with animals for a while, or did this evolve out of something else?
I've been working with animals for quite a while. I started off maybe 8 years ago or so, just doing paintings of tigers, and I made them all kinds of fantastical colors and put different backgrounds in, and that was one sort of strand or phase of my painting. At the same time, I was doing other more realistic things and just sort of going back and forth between the two, sort of trying to figure out which way I wanted to develop or whether I could possibly integrate things and do both. And I'm still sort of working that out. But I have been doing animal paintings for about 8 years. And these
have
sort of... Go ahead.
No, you go. So you've been doing animal paintings for 8 years.
Yeah, they sort of have evolved from the earlier ones, which were just more of an objective depiction of an animal, say, from the side or at a different angle, with all kinds of imaginary backgrounds and things like that. But they've evolved into a kind of a more of a... first of all, I was doing like more wild animals, and there was a more of a distance to be like a tiger or a lion or something like that. There was more of a distance to be had there. But then as things developed, I started getting into working with ideas of more familiar animals and like the household pets and things like that. And then the kind of an automatic thing was to come in a little closer. And as I did that, then it just seemed natural to break things up in terms of abstracting them and introducing other elements, because the dog's or kitten face is so familiar, I could get away with bringing in a lot of other ideas and still having the idea of this animal holding.
Hmm. That makes sense, and that's clear. So I know also that your day job is, which is quite a major one, it's senior designer at Random House, Knopf, and that's also, of course, about, you know, visual culture and looking. And so to talk a little bit about how you approach that, and maybe even about the writer we both know, Laurie Scheck, that I interviewed, and the cover of her book, Monster's Nose, how do you approach that, you know, in terms of book design? That always seems to be such a sort of perplexing area to me, because you have this tremendous amount of latitude in terms of creativity. You don't want to overdo it or underdo it, but that particular cover is kind of, you know, quite minimal and beautiful. So I guess what I'm asking is, if it's possible to articulate, as a designer, how do you approach a book cover, if that's primarily what you're doing, correct me if I'm wrong, and as opposed to a painting, because they're both about, of course, communication in a sense. And we could, if you want, we could start with Monster's Nose.
Sure, that would be a good place to start. I have to say that I'm not. I actually didn't do the cover. I did the interior, and in most book publishing, or trade book publishing at least, like this kind of book, there is a team of artists who do who work on the book covers, and then there's a separate department where the text and the interior is done. And I primarily worked on the interior, which means that I handled a lot of the typographical issues, and then just creating the book pages. So that's more my role.
And so, and generally at the publishing house, that is your role. You're working on interiors most of the time.
Right.
So in that book, which is good to talk about, then that's a. That would seem to be a particularly difficult interior. Her work is poetic. There are, you know, kind of strike-throughs, cross-outs of things. It almost looks like notes. It's kind of a manuscript. Did that pose particular challenges for you? And how was it to work with such an unusual text? Because it's kind of half poetry, half fiction, a combination of the two, and reading it is almost non-narrative. I mean, it is a narrative, but it's a very unusual way to even move through a book, or at least it was for me.
Yes, it's really true, and it's a very atypical book in terms of the kind of work that I normally do, but for me that made it really extra interesting. We had some issues with the book in terms of all the different voices that are heard throughout the book, and each voice was represented by a different typeface or a different type treatment. So you had we just introduced like several different typefaces, and then there were a few places where there was an artifact of a newspaper article or something like that, and then a lot of, like you said, a lot of the strike-throughs and the different line lengths of a poem. So all of those things really, they did have to be meticulously worked out, and that some of that fell to me, and then there's a certain amount that goes to the editorial side, like especially like checking and making sure the author's intention is followed through. But it was a really interesting, that was a really interesting assignment, and I was very glad that I was the one who got to do it, because I learned a lot and enjoyed it a great deal.
And I would think that in a way what you're talking about, and I have the book in front of me and I'm looking at it, is also that, you know, to use different type treatments throughout a book and even type phases is kind of breaking a rule, isn't it, of how you normally would lay out a book in terms of it being, you know, the same typeface or I mean, just to talk about typography a little bit, how do you approach that? That seems very complicated to me, and I'm of course naive in that area, and I would imagine that it's very difficult to make choices, like choosing different typefaces and deciding which ones will go together and different type treatments to separate all these voices without making it look like, you know, a mess, frankly, right?
Right, and that is, it's really a problem, or a part of the game, or the puzzle is to work out these different typefaces so they all harmonize, but they are distinct enough to be to kind of carry their own voice, and like you said, often in a book you'll want to use the same typeface throughout because that's just typical. But with something like Lori's book, the voices, just they needed to change. You just needed to know. We wanted to give the reader a little bit more help to know who was speaking, and that visual cue kind of was used for that reason. And as far as choosing a typeface, we meaning book type designers will often consider something that is maybe from the period or at least would have existed in the period that the book is set in. And this is especially true for something like The Monster's Notes, which was, you know, a 19th century setting.
Right, because we're often talking about, you know, of course, the manuscript of Frankenstein in there. So that's interesting. So 19th century typeface, which I didn't pick up on. I mean, so many of these things are kind of subtle, right? It's the reader isn't aware of the typeface being used, or unless the reader is a designer or a typographer, it's a subtlety of how we read. So, what does that mean, a 19th century typeface? That means what was being used in terms of handset type of in the 19th century, which
yeah,
is...
I mean we can't do that because everything is set on the computer, but you can use a font that was in existence, even if something that might have been created 200 years earlier. At least you're not using something from that looks extremely modern. So you're sort of it's a subtle thing, and it's not overly complex to do it. You just sort of try to say, well, you know, this is set in the 19th century, I'm just going to give it that sort of, implication, I think, that this is a little older. It's not a modern-looking typeface, or the way it sets doesn't look really modern. And then the ornaments that you use with it, you want to have look a little bit from the period. But there's a limited array of fonts that you can use that are like from years gone by. Of course, now there's thousands and thousands of them. So, you know, for something set in the modern times, you can pretty much use anything as long as it's readable.
And is there another book that's not similar, but that was as challenging as that one that you've worked on that you can think of that you'd want to mention?
Well, Let's see, a couple years ago I worked on, and this is a completely different kind of challenge, but I worked on a book that was a companion volume to a Ken Burns documentary. This was about the Roosevelts. And that book had hundreds and hundreds of photos in it. So then you're up against a completely different challenge, which is much more spatial, and it's a lot, and in some ways it's more like a painting. You know, you have your rectangle and you have to fit certain things on, say, a page, and you have a photo or two and a caption or two, and then your text, and then you have, and just trying to make sure that everything gets in, the photos look as clear and as large as they can be, and all the text actually fits. That's the sort of puzzle element of it, is to get things to make sure the text comes out even with the photos, because you can lay things out so that you've got three pages of text left over, and then you have to redo things.
Right. Yeah, that of course makes sense. Now, I mean, that sounds so challenging to me, you know, visually. And if I can kind of just marry the two for a minute, you're an artist making, you know, these paintings that are quite the opposite, and then you're working with all this type and design. They're both about kind of visual culture and communicating. Do they ever mix? I mean, often, you know, I know that artists have, you know, a job that has to do with, you know, visual culture in some way, and it seems divorced from their work, or their work is the opposite. But you have such a sensitivity to type and layout and page design. Do you think that also somehow influences or informs the paintings that you're doing?
I think it does, if at least in the sense that the things you have to pay attention to, like you're paying attention to a process, and that could be, you know, a whole slew of details in terms of, you know, the typeface, the width, is it readable, does it fit? Those are some questions that, or issues that might kind of come up in a painting. Is this balanced? Is the image too high, too low on the canvas? Can you tell what this is, or does this look the way, you know, does this balance that other thing? It's things like those are general visual issues that I think straddle both fields. So in that sense, they feed into one another, because I'm always thinking about the same issues.
Right, that makes sense, and it's great talking to you about both these issues. In closing, I want to ask you the question that I ask everyone, which is, what books are you reading now? A book, if you don't mind me asking.
Well, right now I'm in the middle of a book. I think it's called The Art of Rivalry, which is a kind of mini biographies of pairs of artists. For example, Matisse and Picasso, or Monet and Degas, and de Kooning and Pollock. They're studied in the context of their relationship to one another and their competitiveness. So it's really a fascinating book.
The Art of Rivalry, that's by Sebastian Smee, I believe.
That's right. That's right.
That is exciting. So those are it's about those four artists and their rivalry, because they were living at the same time?
Yes, and they knew one another, and there was a certain, the rivalry is, you know, in the simplest, most basic sense, they're competing with one another, but they're also informing one another's work. Like, they are looking at each other's work, and they're forming a kind of counterpoint to each other, and this sense of competition, but also sharing a certain realm of thought, pushes each partner, or each one of the two artists, further along in their quest for what their art to do.
So So they're actually influencing each other, of course. They're talking to one another visually as well as otherwise. It's fascinating. It sounds like a great book to read.
It's wonderful.
I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been great to hear about your paintings and your design work. Thank you so much, Maggie.
Thank you so much, too. It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.